Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, sort of the teaser version, if you will. What's it teasing? It's teasing 3 times more content. That's right. You got to listen to what you're missing, folks. We've got more interviews, more analysis of the news, and you're missing all of it. And you're missing all of it for the cost of just a couple of pennies a day. So head over to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the Ring of Fire extended podcast, and hear what you've been missing, as well as supporting the show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening and enjoy the program. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, columnist Gideon Rachman will join us to explain why the Trump era could last 30 years. ProPublica's Jesse Eisinger will be here to discuss what happened to the IRS when it tried to take on the ultra-wealthy. Newsflash, it didn't go very well. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to discuss a big week in the news, and Daniel Denver from Jacobin we'll be here to break down what Bernie Sanders' immigration policy should look like without falling into a right-wing trap. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast to Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. And if you like that teaser, support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting the full 3-hour radio show commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, of course, the big news this week on Thursday at about 11 a.m., the Mueller report was released, at least the public version. There was another version that was given to members of Congress. This is a public version that was redacted. Let me just start with this. That, you know, we're a day or so into this. People are still reading this thing carefully, 440 pages. And we're going to have plenty of time to sort of like marinate this thing and make assessments of the report. So let's, you know, keep it broad strokes here, because without, there's a couple of clips of it that I think are relevant to talk about. But, you know, to be honest, like, I need more time to absorb this in a full manner. But let's just start with one thing that is clear, and certainly is clear to me now, that Bill Barr, and look, there was plenty of indications of this. A lot of people like myself said this guy, if you liked, Jeff Sessions, you're going to love Bill Barr. He's just a smarter version of this guy. He was, in the past accused of covering it up an OLC memo and misinterpreting it in front of Congress or misrepresenting it. He was heavily involved in sort of like sweeping a lot of stuff under the rug in the wake of the Iran-Contra scandal. He starts off on Thursday, 9:30 in the morning, with a press conference taking questions about the report with no one having seen the report yet. And this is a quite clear an example. And frankly, we knew an hour and a half later that he had misrepresented what was in the report. But he was the one who got to deliver it. He was the one who got all the press coverage. It's sort of a brilliant press move, because they could have said to Congress, we're not going to give you the report. Eventually, Congress is going to get the report. And if they were to withhold the report and Congress gets it, either by subpoena or by leak or whatever, then we're all watching Gerald Nadler give a press conference and give his interpretations of the report. Instead, we got Bill Barr's, where he said, no collusion. Well, then the report says, we didn't look at collusion because that doesn't exist. We looked at a very narrow definition of conspiracy. He goes on to say, I don't think Mueller expected me to let Congress decide the question of obstruction. And there it is in black and white. He's saying, well, we don't do obstruction because the OLC has told us that we can't bring charges against a sitting president. So we don't want to impede any constitutional means of redress, which are Congress looking at it. I mean, so this was, those are the things that really stuck out for me at the beginning of this process, was that Bill Barr was out there and understood that this was a very damaging report for the president, wanted to make sure that he could put the best spin on it. And the best way to do that was to make sure that people showed up at his press conference when they talk about introducing the report to the public.
Absolutely. Just imagine if William Barr, instead of doing what he has done since March 24th, when the report was delivered to the Justice Department, if instead of doing what he did, which was put out that letter, and then, in several different, in testimony before Congress and further letters, sort of try and sort of prepare the ground, right, with all of this kind of PR that he's been doing. Imagine if he'd have done what a normal attorney general or prosecutor would have done, which is that he would have said, he would have come out, he would have delivered this redacted version of the report. He would have explained what those redactions were about and what the reasoning was behind it. He would have done it before he had any kind of a press conference about it, and he would have taken questions about it. In fact, I'm totally wrong. It wouldn't be Barr. He would have had Mueller up there. The fact that Mueller was missing from this whole thing, that he was, have you ever seen that before? I mean, I've watched a lot of these things where they have, it was Patrick Fitzgerald or, any of these special counsels, Ken Starr, over the years, Robert Ray. The people who do the investigation are the ones who deliver, the report or the charges, whatever that is, and they are the ones who give take questions. The fact that Mueller's missing from all this, I find really astonishing. And what it speaks to, and other people made this observation as well, is that there is some dissonance between Mueller and Barr. I mean, and Barr was asked about it in his press conference, and he just sort of shrugged it off and got angry and actually stomped off at the end of the press conference before anybody could, because they were starting to get a little aggressive with him and say, what is this? Why isn't he there? Why did you give the heads up to the White House and didn't give it to Congress? What they were trying to pin him down a little bit, and he got angry and left. So, there's something very wrong with all of that. I mean, that part of this whole thing is just astonishing, because what it speaks to is the fact that you have an attorney general who is really operating as the president's personal lawyer, not as the people's lawyer, as attorney general. It's always kind of a tough row to hoe for any attorney general when a president's under investigation, but that's what the special counsel's for. That's right. Why they do that, because there's an inherent conflict, and Barr shouldn't have been involved in any of that. He should have let Mueller be the one to make the presentation and take the questions and be the one. So what he's done is ask for some very, very tough congressional hearings. I mean, that is what's going to happen, and they're going to have Mueller up. They're going to have all these people up. They have to. I don't think they have any choice, because the way Barr has presented this whole thing and not being available to answer any questions just, it basically raises all the questions that have to be answered still by the people who were involved.
Yeah, and I think this was, I think this is a deliberate, way to stretch this thing out and make this diffuse, this story more diffuse in the public's eye and take the pressure off of a Democratic Congress to, to investigate. And I think there is a reluctance on the Democrats to do that. We will talk about that in a moment. Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, let's talk about what happens next. Again, we are still in the process of assessing what the report says. There are a couple of things in there that really struck me, particularly the obstruction stuff, and also what was tantamount to an admission by the Mueller people that, like, look, they did a good job of covering up their tracks. and yep. And we couldn't establish certain things. But let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about that. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we mentioned that, of course, the Mueller report is out. We haven't had a chance to fully digest it. It's been out for about 24 hours or so. And this is, you know, it's going to take a little bit of time. But there are a couple of things that jump out at me that I found quite astonishing, particularly in light of how Bill Barr has been representing this thing. The obstruction, it's clear that Mueller thought that his office was not in a position to bring charges of obstruction against a sitting president because they were bound by the Office of Legal Counsel's direction that a sitting president should not be subjected to criminal charges. And they didn't want to bring these charges in part because of that and in part because they did not want to interfere with what they called the constitutional processes that involve. I'll read that quote here. It is, this office accepted the OLC's legal conclusion for the purpose of exercising prosecutorial jurisdiction. And apart from the OLC's constitutional view, we recognize that a federal criminal accusation against a sitting president would place burdens on the president's capacity to govern and potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. Those words, constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct, talk about impeachment. And so therefore, he was basically saying, like, this is the purview of Congress.
Oh, absolutely. I honestly always kind of figured that was the reason that they, you know, Barr sort of put that weird truncated quote in there about how it's not exonerated, that there was much more to that. And if you read through, I mean, I like you, I'm still digesting the whole thing, but it's obvious that Mueller believed that. I mean, he didn't lay out any exoneration of Trump on the obstruction. All he did was he laid out all the details about the obstruction and then included some letters from the Trump legal team defending him. That's the extent of the both sides, you know, and the idea that, well, I just couldn't figure out what to do. I mean, that was absurd. Mueller was the head of the FBI for 10 years. He was a prosecutor for decades. Of course, he could have made a, you know, it wasn't like he didn't know how or didn't understand. He was following the OLC guidelines, which say that a sitting president can't be indicted. And he also acknowledged, and I think this is fair, that were he to call him an unindicted co-conspirator or something like that, to obstruction of justice, Trump would have had that hanging over his head. So it's up to the Congress to make that call. That is how the Constitution lays out how you deal with a sitting president who has committed crimes. And these are high crimes and misdemeanors, which are not necessarily part of the criminal statutes. This is a different sort of, kind of definition of what the duties of a president are. And, you know, I think that Mueller saw this. I mean, all you have to do is look at it. The day that Mueller was named as a special counsel, Trump is quoted in the report as saying, "This is the end of my presidency. I'm effed." I mean, he said this, and you know, there's a reason for that. I was always curious about why he was so upset about Sessions being recused. I mean, as if he really truly believed that somehow or another Robert Mueller was going to nail him to the wall. In a way, he got lucky because he didn't get charged in the collusion side of it. Although I have to say, from what I can tell from looking at it, there's plenty of evidence of collusion as we understand it. It just doesn't fall under the criminal statutes of conspiracy. It's outrageous what they did during the campaign. I mean, they had, you know, Manafort was passing, you know, battleground polling information in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania to someone that Mueller acknowledges was involved with Russian agents. I mean, there's so much of of that stuff. I mean, the fact that they were too stupid to know that they were, you know, doing the wrong thing over and over again. I believe that. I mean, I actually believe that's true, that Trump and his family were just really so stupid. They were dumb as, you know, boxes of rocks. They just didn't know how to do any of this because they had no business being in a presidential campaign in the first place. But that doesn't get them off the hook. I mean, as a president, you have a duty to be smart enough to know that when you're doing these things that it's wrong. So that's another issue for the Congress to look at. You know, that's the definition of, like, high crimes, and it might be a high misdemeanor. You know, high crimes don't mean they're higher than regular crimes. It means they're crimes and misdemeanors committed by people in high places. And
right.
So it's a whole different kind of framework for how you understand whether or not that's wrong. So, you know, this report in no way exonerates the president. And the fact that they went out there and did this big PR spin, I mean, I'm not sure it's working. I mean, it'll work for
don't,
people.
I don't think so.
I mean, there's just too much.
I don't think so. And look, you know, one of the things it brings about is that we've seen the Supreme Court, talk about the concept of corruption, right, where it's not enough that you have aligned interests and you're aware of your aligned interests. And an oil company gives you a big campaign gift,
right,
and you decide, I'm going to do stuff for oil companies. If there is no explicit, I will give you this gift, and you do stuff for oil companies written, then there's no corruption, at least from a legal perspective. And that sort of seems what that is analogous to what we have here, where they were aware of what Russia was doing. Russia was aware of what the Trump people were doing. I mean, look, people are sophisticated. People go through this in their business dealings every day. George Down, you know, in accounting does one thing that's good for me. I do one thing that's good for them. I mean, and we understand this is the dynamic. So this is what's going on there. And there is, that's what the law is, but that doesn't mean that you can't be subjected to some form of punishment and held to account by Congress. And so
that's transparency, right? I mean,
yeah,
that part of it, which, I mean, all we have is this, and it's really astonishing. The Mueller report is a really fascinating and astonishing document. What it details about the Trump campaign transition and administration just on this issue, right? I mean, God only knows what else they're doing. But, I mean, this is just on this one issue. And the transparency that's required, I mean, I'm hearing people kind of, you know, well, maybe this should be it, and Democrats shouldn't follow up because, you know, impeachment's bad. Pelosi said, I don't believe in impeachment, basically. Just it doesn't, we can't do it at all. I mean, I guess unless he shoots somebody on Fifth Avenue.
Well, the point is, we need answers to this stuff, and they need to be resolved. But we're out of time. Let's talk more in the next hour. We've got other things to talk about, and we'll be talking about this topic in the weeks to come, no doubt.
Yes, we will.
I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Quick break. Coming up, Gideon Rachman will explain why the Trump era will last well into the future. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. In a time where presidential election cycles seem to never end, it's hard to think about the consequences of our elections in terms of how it will affect the future. According to our next guest, the Trump era could last for 30 more years. Here to explain, Gideon Rachman from the Financial Times. So, Gideon, we are clearly in a new era. Maybe it's a couple years old now, but it is a it clearly has its definitions. But before we talk about how long it might last, why it might last that long, what are the implications that will come from this era? I mean, define it for us a little bit. I mean, you referred to it as the Trump era, but that's really just sort of a marker in some way. What constitutes the Trump era? And when we talk about the era, are we talking about how global is it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think obviously we're all just beginning to try to define it and to figure out what it all means. And I would imagine, you know, historians will be thinking about this in 100 years' time if we're all still around, and kids will be writing school essays on it. But so this is if you're making a first stab at it, though, you might as well look at what Trump and the people around himself say about what it is they think they're doing and how they would define their movement. And I think that, you know, one of the things that, say, the Steve Bannons, who I think is probably intellectually one of the more important figures in the Trump movement, talked about was a backlash against globalism, by which they define, you know, we used to talk about globalization, which was more of a kind of economic, technological idea. But I think for the Bannons and Trump has come to embody that, globalism, as they see it, is a kind of ideology and an effort to break down barriers, and that, which they argue has been detrimental to ordinary Americans, both in terms of mass migration, which obviously they've made a huge issue of, build the wall, the attempted ban on Muslims and all of that, but also in terms of a backlash against freer trade, launching of tariff wars. Trump famously said tariffs are good and that trade wars are good things and easy to win. And those were big reversals of the prevailing ideology, really, for the previous 30 years. And I think that the other element that you touched upon is, yes, I think you can see there is now a kind of global movement, which means that Trump isn't an isolated figure anymore. So that just recently you had the election of a new president in Brazil, President Bolsonaro, who's kind of styled himself as the Trump of the tropics and uses a lot of the same language, denunciations of globalism, denunciations of what he calls the politically correct, similar kind of right-wing philosopher figures behind him who go on about what they call cultural Marxism. And it's not just Bolsonaro, I think, is a significant figure because Brazil is, you know, the fifth biggest country in the world. But there are others, Netanyahu in Israel, who interestingly preceded Trump, but uses a lot of the same rhetoric about the fake news media. And Trump has actually popularized that kind of term, the idea and that methodology, the idea of attacking the liberal media as the enemy, is now very common. You see it a lot in Europe as well, Prime Minister of Hungary, Viktor Orban. So there are quite a few Trump-like figures, I think possibly because the United States is obviously, you know, it's the most powerful country in the world. And so a big change in the politics there inevitably has global effects.
And we should say, I mean, because as you're describing it, you know, we go from some trade policies, which I don't know how significant in terms of a change it is, as much as it is sort of like somewhat cosmetic, although it's certainly damaged some of the people ostensibly it's supposed to help in this country. And you talk about the rise of an anti-immigrant sentiment. But when we head down to Bolsonaro and when we go and look at Netanyahu, we're looking not only those elements. I mean, Bolsonaro's on the floor of the version of the Senate there, you know, basically saying that if his kids were gay, he would kill them, more or less.
Yeah.
And you do have Netanyahu talking about the media. I mean, so on some level, there's a certain authoritarian quality, you know, fascistic, I don't know if you could say fascist, but fascistic,
yeah,
quality.
Well,
here,
I mean,
to
I
that
think,
as
you
well.
Know, if you wanted to go even further, that, I mean, I think actually if we are looking at a kind of era of strongman politics, you know, self-styled strongman, Trump, as I say, because of the position of the United States, is the dominant figure. But people like him were popping up in international politics really for almost a decade before Trump arrived. You know, you could point to Erdogan in Turkey, who came in 2003 and initially was seen as a Democrat, actually somebody who would consolidate democracy in Turkey, but has become increasingly authoritarian and given to, if you like, Trump-style conspiracy theories, attacks on the media. Now, because Turkey's democracy is much less entrenched, it's actually led to, you know, pretty terrible abuses, mass arrests of journalists and so on. I think more journalists in prison in Turkey than any country bar China. But Erdogan's another example, but you could look even at Putin. Again, in a different context, I'm not saying that, right, you know, that Russia and America are the same, but that kind of style, the macho style of leadership, you know, one of the famous things that Trump said was, I alone can fix it. And I think that's very much the proposition that Putin would put forward in Russia, that Xi Jinping would put forward in China, that Narendra Modi would put forward in India. Again, in India in a democratic context. But again, a sort of strongman figure who said, you know, I'm going to get tough. And similarly, Modi's interesting because there's an undercurrent of anti-Muslim sentiment, a big stress on the need to get tough on terrorism. So there are common themes. They play out in different, obviously, different right. in contexts in different countries. But some of the stuff of the basing of the liberal media, the turning on Muslims in particular, these are playing out across a number of countries.
And do you think, I mean, do you think that that quality, because obviously you're right, I mean, the context in which you have a strong man, let's say, in Russia would be different from the context in which you have a strong man in the United States, or, you know, Netanyahu is displaying the same things, Modi, I mean, across the board, as you say. If we go to 30,000 feet and look down, what is the similarity? So, because it seems to me that just from a completely from, you know, almost divorced of the specifics of these contexts, what they suggest are countries, are a body politic that is sort of overwhelmed with, I want to say, confusion or frustration or something. I mean, when you look to someone who says, I'm going to take care of this, like this is just me here, and you don't have to operate on any type of complexity or whatnot, it looks to me like, on some level, you have a body politic that's overwhelmed in some fashion, that can't figure things out, that's overcome with confusion or whatnot, and just wants simplicity.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, one of the common themes to all these strongmen figures, whether they're operating in democracies or autocracies, is they're usually nationalists. So in that sense, it is part of this backlash against globalism and against what is seen as a sort of detached international elite that is portrayed as looking after its own interests, but isn't loyal to the nation. And I think, again, a lot of the figures, again, spanning democracies and autocracies, the strongman figures tend to play on a sense of national humiliation, so that Putin would say, look, you know, the Soviet Union fell apart, and the world took advantage of Russia, but I'm the guy who can put it right. Xi Jinping has made the whole of China, or Chinese kids, all have to learn about the China's century of humiliation in the 19th century with the lesson that the Communist Party and the head of the Communist Party, Xi, who will put this right. And then you see, in a way, translated into an American context, Trump saying similar stuff, that the whole world is laughing at us. How many times did he say that during the campaign? The idea that we've been taken advantage of, that in some sense we've been humiliated, and we need to be smarter, tougher. That is a common theme. And again, you know, the other figures I mentioned, Erdogan, Modi in India, same stuff. I mean, the Turks have a very kind of paranoid view of the world, going all the way back to the dismemberment of the Ottoman Empire. This idea that they have no real friends in the world, they need a strong man to protect them. And in India, even though India is doing well economically, obviously there's the memory of colonialism, but also a frustration in India that they feel that they've been subjected to terror attacks sponsored by Pakistan, and previous right. governments have been too weak to respond. So when Modi bombed Pakistan just recently, it was wildly popular. And again, you know, Netanyahu, the same idea that an element of paranoia
and
is maybe
fear.
Too strong a word, but the sense that, you know, the world is against us. People are taking advantage of us, and unless we have a really strong leader, we're going to be in trouble.
Right. All right, Gideon, let's take a break. And now that we've sort of defined what this era is about, let's talk about how long it may last and why we might think it might last that long. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back after this. Back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking with columnist Gideon Rachman about his piece in the Financial Times, The Trump Era Could Last 30 Years. So, Gideon, in the last segment, we were talking about the defining attributes of, you know, for lack of a better term, the Trump era, one that is marked by globally by a certain sort of right-wing populism, anti-immigrant sentiment, nationalism, looking to a strong authoritarian-ish type of leader in different contexts for perhaps different reasons, but to deal with what is a sense of like a sense of perhaps national humiliation or lack of confidence or some or aggrievement. In some way, I mean, this is clearly an era. We could define it in a couple of different ways, but I think from a broad perspective, that is it. So the question you pose is, how long is this going to last? And your answer, at least your best guess, is 30 years. Why 30 years?
Well, it's you know, obviously we're speculating, but right. I think that it's possible to argue that In the period after the Second World War, we've seen two 30-year periods. So after 45 to the mid-70s, you had a period that the French called the 30 Glorious Years, but it was a more broad Western phenomenon of economic reconstruction, rapidly rising living standards in the West, and also both in Europe and in the U.S., the expansion of the state to provide more services. So in the U.S., you had the Great Society in the 60s, and in Britain, the creation of the welfare state, and so on. But by the mid-70s, there's a sense that that program has kind of run out of road a bit. You have stagflation. You have a sense of malaise, as Carter put it, in America. In Britain, it was a very bad period economically. And then I think a new era starts around 79, 80, Thatcher's elected in Britain, Reagan is elected in America, but it's also, again, a global phenomenon because you have Mao dying in China in 76 and the beginning of the opening of China, again, in 78, 79, the same period that Reagan and Thatcher come to power. And I think that you get another 30-year period, which I guess its critics would call the neoliberal period, when it was dominated by free market reforms, deregulation, lower taxes, globalization, and it takes in the fall of the Berlin Wall, the creation of a really truly global economy after the end of the Cold War. And for a while, that all seems to be going one way, and you get almost a global consensus that there is that's the way to run an economy, and everyone is forming around what the World Bank calls the Washington Consensus on how to run economies. But then it starts in 78, this second era, but probably ends in 2008 with the financial crisis, so another 30-year period. After the financial crisis, you get a sense that, okay, something's really gone badly wrong, and a period of uncertainty, people looking around for new models. And I think by 2016, it's clear that we are now in a different phase, the populist phase.
Right.
2016, I think, is the sort of probably will come to be seen as the breakthrough year for populism, because you have the Britain voting to leave the European Union, the Brexit referendum in June of that year, Trump winning in November of that year. And Trump's people definitely saw a connection with Brexit. I once saw Steve Bannon claiming that he thought that the moment he claimed he knew that Trump was going to win was when Britain voted for Brexit, because it was a similar group of people tended to be the less educated section of society. I mean, just empirically, though, if you don't have a degree, you are much more likely to vote for Brexit, much more likely to vote for Donald Trump. And the group who felt a squeeze on their living standards. And also, I think there's often a big city, small town divide. So in Britain, the big cities, London, Glasgow, and so on, voted to stay in the EU, but they were outvoted by the smaller towns and the countryside. Right. And I think similar pattern with the U.S.
We should say, were the U.S. presidency a referendum, Hillary Clinton would be the president now, right?
Absolutely,
I mean,
yeah.
3 million
votes. The other thing is that, I mean, I think it's worth noting that, you know, so you ask, well, how long is this going to last? You know, if you've had two other 30-year periods, it's at least worth considering that maybe this isn't just some weird aberration, that if you take that plus the fact you have a kind of global populist movement going on, that maybe this is another big ideological shift which could go on for decades.
Yeah, it's fascinating. We just have about 2.5 more minutes here. And I wonder if, I mean, it's interesting to contemplate whether, you know, there are those who argue that the neoliberal era was the result of a longstanding plan, right? We had Mont Pelerin at the end of World War II. For 20, 30 years, these neoliberal thinkers were out in the cold, as it were, and mm-hmm. they saw an opportunity during these crises, largely in some respects brought about by, oil shocks and whatnot. But there were other factors going on. They took advantage of it. And then in some respects, there are people who argue that what we're seeing now is a result of the sort of the natural result of when you create policies that create this type of wealth inequality and leave people feeling like their government is no longer is functioning in the way that it's supposed to in terms of helping people, broadly speaking. And then maybe we take it out of the hands of the bureaucrats and put it in the hands of a, some type of a strong, authoritarian type leader. Let me ask you this. We just got a minute left. It's also conceivable mm-hmm. that in this country, Donald Trump could win another election. That would certainly cement this down the road. That would be 8 years right there. Sure. No reason to believe that we would just snap out of it. But let's say Bernie Sanders comes in and there's a different turn taken. I mean, how would that implicate things? Do you think internationally? Do you think that's possible? I mean, what's your sense on that?
In a funny way, you could say that there are two variants of populism running. There's the right populism represented by Trump, but there's also the left populism represented by Bernie Sanders, who has some of the same themes, you know, anti-elite, anti-globalist, but obviously interpreted in a very different fashion. And I think just as Trump had an enormous impact on world politics, spawned a whole series of imitators. If a Sanders or a Warren figure were to win in the U.S., that would also have a global impact. And you can already see in my own country, Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party, who, like Sanders, is way to the left of the traditional leaders of his party. So there's a global shift to the extremes, if you like, certainly as defined by the previous era. The era of centrist technocracy is over. You've had the right-wing reaction with Trump, and now I think you have a very powerful left-wing reaction, which is a serious challenger. But what it has in common with Trump is a rejection of the previous era.
Gideon Rachman, really interesting stuff. I appreciate your time today.
Pleasure.
Gideon Rachman is the chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. I know the score.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.